G'day and welcome to episode 58 of this podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas and I'm here as ever with my logophile friend, David Grigg.
Hello, Perry. You've been peripatetic, I think. You've been wandering around Victoria, I believe.
Well, I'm up in Mildura at this time, so if the quality of the recording here is not as not up to what it is when I'm at home, that's the reason. I'm in a strange apartment in Mildura. Well, it's not strange; it's quite nice. But I'm up in Mildura. We took three times to get here from all the lockdowns. We'd cancelled it twice after booking it, and almost had to cancel it again. We were thinking of doing that last week when we were in the hard lockdown that we had then. And then we came out on Tuesday. And we didn't come out just a little bit at a time. We just got pretty much opened up for the whole of Victoria. So we thought...
Yeah, that's true. It's still some tough restrictions still.
Yeah, but the point is it doesn't mean I wasn't being held into a 5 or 25 kilometre radius. I could go somewhere.
Yeah, you were allowed to travel, yeah. You were allowed to travel within Victoria, yeah.
That's right. And so we were pretty desperate to get out and get into the countryside and get away from all the buildings and get out of the house. And so we just took off and we came up to Mildura, and it's warmer and it's... Unfortunately, we can't get into South Australia nor into New South Wales because they're both locked down, or at least their borders are locked. But it's very amusing, David, when you walk down along the river here at Mildura and you look across the river and there are people across the river camping in the caravan park, and you wave to them and they wave back, and that's all you can
never
do.
Never the twain shall meet, yes.
50 metres away and you can't go there, and you look up and there's the bridge and the police at the end of the bridge pulling everybody off and telling everybody. You know, you can go from Victoria into New South Wales, absolutely no problem whatsoever, because New South Wales haven't blocked Victorians going in. It's just the other way.
You don't want to, if you want to come back, you're in trouble.
Yeah. If you want to come back, you're in trouble. So we could go to, say, Broken Hill or Mungo National Park. Trouble is we can't get back for 14 days. Well, we could, but we have to isolate for 14 days.
That's no good.
And so, unfortunately, that's not it. But there we go. That's just it. Anyway, but moving on to what we were going to talk about in this particular episode of the podcast, David, there's a number of awards that are cropping up. It seems to be middle of the year from around about Easter onwards. You seem to get awards cropping up every couple of days, and it's not just in the science fiction and fantasy fields. There's other Australian literary awards and also crime awards as well. So we'll be covering bits and pieces of all of those. But the first one I wanted to talk about, and because you'll be interested in what a number of the titles that are on this particular list, is the Ned Kelly Award shortlist.
Indeed.
Now, the Ned Kelly Award is presented by the Crime Writers of Australia organisation, and it is aimed at honouring the best fiction from the previous calendar year in the crime genre written by Australian citizens or Australian residents. I'm not entirely sure which of those is correct, but let's just say Australian writers and be done with it, and we'll just we'll wave our hands around and go, well, we're not terribly sure. Anyway, on the list... It's a damn good list, let me tell you. I think you're going to like some of this. Consolation by Gary Disher, which I've discussed on the podcast and which you're moving towards reading sometime later this year.
Yes, I've read the first in that series and have yet to read the next two of this is the third of them. But, yeah, I look forward to reading it.
Gathering Dark, Candice Fox.
Which I talked about on the podcast, yeah.
Yep, which I still haven't got to read yet, so I've still got to get to that one.
That's good.
Yep, A Testament of Character by Solari Gentile. She won this award in 2018 for Crossing the Line, and I know I've had a few people tell me that her work is definitely worthwhile catching up on. So another one we have to look at.
Yep.
That's one, two, three, four. The fourth one, The Survivors, Jane Harper, which I talked about.
Yes.
The Good Turn, Duvla McTiernan.
Yes.
So this is a good list. It's actually longer than I thought. There's a few more on it. Yeah. The next one is one that I don't know anything about. This is Tell Me Lies by an author called J.P. Pomare, P-O-M-A-R-E.
Mm-hmm.
He's a New Zealander living in Melbourne. His first novel, Call Me Evie, won the Nao Marsh Award for Best First Novel. That's the New Zealand equivalent for crime fiction for the Ned Kelly Award, so the Nao Marsh Award. She was a major New Zealand writer back in the first half of the 20th century, I believe.
Nao Marsh. Mm.
Yep, Nao Marsh. And then we have When She Was Good by Michael Rowbotham.
Yep.
Another one of yours that you've discussed, I believe.
Yep.
And the last one is another one that I don't know, White Throat by Sarah Thornton, which is a sequel to her earlier novel, Lapse, which picked up some good reviews by the sounds of things. So there's a couple there that we should try and read. Now, these are going to be coming out, they're going to be announced very shortly. They really don't give you very much time to actually read the shortlist, which is a bit disappointing. I mean, if I was going to say one thing to the Ned Kelly Award organisers, give people a bit of time to actually read them
and
catch
up. Yeah, that's right.
So we've got, between the two of us, we've got three that we need to read. Now, between the two of us, if we had a month, we could get through that.
Sure.
But when you've got a couple of weeks, and it just pops up, bang, suddenly it's got to be done again. Bit disappointing, but that's it. That's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to criticise them for anything else because they do a great job, and it's a damn good list, let me tell you. There's a lot of good books on that list.
Sure.
Would not know. I'd like to see the Disher win, but then I'm a big Disher fan. But, you know, the McTiernan could win, the Harper could win, the Fox could win, the Rowbotham could win. I mean, any of the ones that we've read, as far as I recall, we all liked. So
yeah, sure.
That's good. Okay, next one, moving on along. The World Fantasy Award shortlists have been announced as well. Now, these are the World Fantasy Award is handed out. The World Fantasy Convention, which is going to be held this year over the first weekend in November in Montreal, Quebec. Now, it's all the World Fantasy Convention is always held as close as possible to Halloween. So that's it's just the affectation that they have. That's just basically what they do, and that's fine. It basically says that's exactly when it's going to be, so you know that's when it is each year. So that's a good thing. Now, the World Fantasy Award only gives awards to works of fantasy. Now, that's a big question that we've had some discussions about.
What is fantasy?
Which we may actually have some more discussions about on this podcast coming up if we can get our acts together and talk about it.
Sure.
The very reason being that, for example, in the novel nominees are Peter Nasey by Susanna Clarke, which you're a bit dubious about as to whether that's fantasy or not, but we'll leave that for another discussion.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But we really both enjoyed that. That was good. And I would be quite happy for her to win this particular award.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
The next one is Trouble the Saints by Alaya Dawn Johnson, sorry, don't know that one. The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones. I've read something by him that has got some very good reviews, that book, and is, if I can stretch a bit of horror in there, because I believe it is horror, I would basically be moving towards reading that this year. The next one is Mexican Gothic, another horror novel by Silvia Moreno-Garcia.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one is The Midnight Bargain by C.L. Polk. This, I believe, is the start of a new series that she's got. She won the World Fantasy Award a couple of years ago for her debut, which I quite enjoyed. So that's those. One to five. On the novella, there's some here that you will recognise. Ring Shout by P. Djeli Clark. Stepsister by Leia Sipes from Fantasy and Science Fiction. I don't know that one because I don't purchase the science fiction magazines anymore. I was getting so many in the house and not reading them. They were just piling up, and it just seemed to me a waste of time. So I'd just wait to the end and pick the eye teeth out of them and do what I need to then. Fly Away by the Australian author Kathleen Jennings. This is a fantasy novella set in Queensland, where she lives. I've read this. I thought it was just a bit overcomplicated, but anyway. Four Profound Weaves, which I finished on the weekend, by R.B. Lemberg. That's also a bit complicated. Really wanted to like it, but I just got confused. And the last one is Riot Baby by Tochi Onibuchi, which we have discussed as well.
Sure.
Of those, without having read Stepsister, I've read four of the five. I'd go for Riot Baby because we've discussed Ring Shout. Last episode, I think we discussed Ring Shout when we talked about novellas. And we thought that that was probably going to win the Hugo Novella Award. It will probably win this one as well.
But Ring Shout, yeah.
Yeah, Ring Shout, we'll probably do that. But let's not preempt too much. The World Fantasy Award winners sometimes throw up some interesting differences. You look at it and you go, okay. And then you read them and you go, I understand why that one got up now. So that's, yeah, that's interesting. Now, the last one that I want to talk about today is in the literary field, Australian literary field, and it's a reinstatement, the Age Book of the Year Award, and the shortlist has now been announced. Now, the Age Book of the Year, the Age being the major newspaper, broadsheet, if they call it broadsheet newspaper, the big, big newspaper in Melbourne, affiliated with the Sydney Morning Herald. The Age Book of the Year Award was stopped about 10 years ago, 2012, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
But a number of sponsors have got together and have decided to bring it back and reinstate it, which is a good thing. The nominees are The Rain Heron by Robbie Arnott.
Mm-hmm.
I've discussed this. This was a pretty good book, really enjoyed it. The Tolstoy Estate by Stephen Conti. Now, Stephen Conti's an interesting writer. I haven't read his first one. The first book he wrote was called The Zookeeper's War, and it won the first Prime Minister's Literary Award back in 2008. Yeah. And this is only his second novel.
Yeah,
so he's written some short stories on and some journalism between the two, but this is only his second novel in 13 years. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
The next one, The Living Sea of Waking Dreams by Richard Flanagan, another book on my very long to-be-read list.
Yes.
Flanagan won the 2014 Booker Prize for The Narrow Road to the Deep North. People might remember that one. Next nominee is A Room Made of Leaves by Kate Grenville. She was the author of The Secret River, one of the best Australian novels of the first part of this century. It won the Cromwell Writers' Prize in 2006. Next nominee, The Labyrinth by Amanda Lowry, which I've discussed. It won the Miles Franklin Award. The next one, Song of the Crocodile by Nadi Simpson. Hadn't heard of this. I believe it's a debut. But it won the 2021 Australian Literary Society Gold Medal, which is also one of the top ones floating around. So that was announced a while back, but I missed that one. I'm sorry, David, didn't discuss it, that one on the podcast, but there That's we okay. go. Can't get all of them. I think we've
spent
all. If we spoke about every single award in the either literary or genre fields, we'd be here all day.
We would, yeah. Well, yes. I was going to mention the fact that the Booker Prize long list is also out, but we won't go through that. It's quite
long. No, we won't go through it, but we will mention it in a minute. The last one nominated for the Age Book of the Year Award is Bored Into This by Adam Thompson. This is his debut novel. He's a Indigenous writer from Tasmania, and that's also getting some good reception. So a very interesting list there. Now, and as you alluded...
Preempted.
That's all right. The 2021 Booker Prize, no longer the Man Booker Prize, but now the straight Booker Prize long list has been announced. There's 13 titles on the long list. I'm not going to go through the whole lot of them, but I'm going to mention four of them which Locus Magazine has indicated have genre interest. So that is, basically science fiction and fantasy elements or adjacent, if you like.
Yeah.
Now, these are Second Place by Rachel Cusk.
Mm-hmm.
Bit odd. I don't know what sort of genre things this would have. From what I've heard about it, it doesn't sound like even a genre adjacent novel, but hey, Lucas has basically put it that way. Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro, or Sir Kazuo Ishiguro.
Yeah, that looks very interesting. I must read that.
Well, we should basically read, he's written two or three which really fit heavily into the genre categories. Mm. We should basically just concentrate on him one time.
Yeah, sure.
Bewilderment by Richard Powers, American writer, and Light Perpetual by Francis Spufford, who I know the name, but I know nothing about that particular book. So there's a lot of awards floating around. We shall hopefully put the links up to the up on the show notes, so that if people want to go and have a look, they can.
Sure.
The genre ones are always collected on Locus Magazine, and I would always recommend people to go there. And if you like the work they're doing, subscribe. I'm a subscriber. I think that it's worthwhile doing that. I get a lot of information from Locus Magazine, and I think it's a very worthwhile publication in the field. I just wish there was something similar to it in the crime fiction field. That would be very worthwhile, I think. But unfortunately, I can't find anything. Maybe there is. There's some that sort of cover bits of it, but not in the totality that Locus Magazine attempts to do. So there we are. That's it for the awards for this week.
It's quite a lot.
Quite a lot. Quite a lot for people to have a look at. And if you wanted to, even if you just wanted to read the winners of all the awards,
you'd be hard put.
You'd be struggling. Mm. But we will try and keep you on top of them all and let you know what comes up. So, anything you want to add to any of that sort of stuff?
No, that's perfectly fine.
All right, okay, cool, good. We'll move on then and move on to our main topic of the conversation for this week, and that is what television we've been watching lately. Mm. So do you want to kick us off, David?
I can do that, yeah. Now, I always have to start with by prefacing the fact that I watch very little television, indeed. But I've watched three things which I will talk about today. So, all right, the first one of these is called Absentia. I presume that's how you pronounce it, Absentia. And this is on Amazon Prime. I think it's an Amazon Prime original. Amazon original? I think it is. Anyway, I watched my way through the first season of this, and it was interesting enough. I'm thinking I probably won't go on to watch the second and third seasons, which there are already out. Okay, so it's a thriller, if you like. It's set in the Boston area of the United States, and it stars Stana Katic as Emily Byrne. Now, she's an FBI officer, and as the story opens, she's been missing for 6 years. She's been presumed dead, and they think that she's the victim of a man that she was investigating as a suspected serial killer. Now, this man is now serving a life sentence in jail for her murder, but her body was never found. Now, Nick Durand, her husband, has since married again to a woman called Alice, and together they've been looking after Nick and Emily's son, Flynn, who's now about 11 years old. So that's the background that we eventually discover as the series goes on, but we don't know much of that at the start, of course. But the first episode, I just wanted to describe the opening episode because it's quite disturbing. So it starts with some happy family shots, Emily and Nick and their child Flynn, who in these photos is about 3 or 4 years old. And then we get a cut to Emily, and she's in some really grubby location, and her hands are bound, and she's being bashed repeatedly in the face, her mouth bleeding. Then we cut again, and we go to a scene of her inside a huge glass tank, which is sealed at the top, with water being pumped in at a great rate. And as the water gets closer and closer to the top, she's desperately trying to breathe the remaining air, get her nose up above the water and breathe the remaining air. But it's clear that she's going to drown. So it's really scary stuff. And then we get the title sequence coming up. All right, so that's how it starts. So partway into the first episode, her husband Nick gets a call in the middle of the night. And it seems to be from Conrad Harlow, who's the man who's still in jail for Emily's murder. Harlow tells Nick that Emily, in fact, is alive and that Nick has 60 minutes to reach an address that Harlow gives him or Emily will be gone for good. So, ignoring panicky questions from his new wife, Alice, Nick rushes to the address with some FBI backup he's called for, and they're following him, and to find an old cottage Inside the cottage is a large glass tank filling with water, with someone inside it. Desperately, they break open the tank, and sure enough, it's Emily, by now unconscious. So there's all sorts of mysteries here. Where has she been for 6 years? Why doesn't she have any memory of that time? How did Conrad Harlow, if it was him calling Nick, arrange these events, and why? And now that Emily's been found alive, it's clear that Harlow, who's only in jail for her murder, will have to be released. Because even though the FBI strongly suspects him of a series of murders, they were only able ever to pin him down on Emily's murder, which kind of raises the question on what kind of evidence, because, you know, they obviously didn't find her body, so, you know, if she wasn't actually murdered, what was the FBI's evidence? Anyway, never mind. It has to be released because she's now being found. So the show does a pretty good job of piling complication upon complication. Emily doesn't seem quite sane after the trauma of her abduction and torture, naturally enough. And she's also found out that she's lost 6 years of her life that she just doesn't remember. And she hasn't sort of seen her family in that time. So as she tries to work out what's happened to her and why, she begins herself to run foul of the law. And she ends up on the run after Conrad Harlow, who's now been released from prison, is found dead in the pool of his luxury apartment. And Emily was caught on CCTV driving near the building on the night of Harlow's murder, and she becomes the prime suspect. So she goes on the run. So it's a bit like, you know, the Fugitive series, if you remember that, or the movie based on that.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, so there's some good emotional issues with it. I think Emily, of course, wants to reconnect with her young son, Flynn, who is suddenly, you know, he's now 11 years old and she only remembers him as a 3 or 4 year old. And so she wants to reconnect with him, but young Flynn now thinks of Alice as his mother, and he really struggles to deal with his relationship with this slightly crazy, you know, biological mother who's just turned up. Alice, of course, Nick's new wife, is also in emotional difficulties because it's clear that Nick is still in love with Emily, and presumably Alice's marriage to him is now invalid. But Nick doesn't ever seem to understand. This is where you think, is this deliberate or this is just bad writing? Because Nick never seems to connect with the turmoil she's suffering. And there are several times you sort of want to kick him, but, you know, who knows. But he really doesn't treat her well and see what she's suffering in that regard. I thought that was a bit poor. Anyway, you know, it's plenty of exciting action, tension, interesting plot twists, probably one or two too many plot twists, all of which seem to be resolved and wrapped up neatly in the final episode of the series, until right at the very end, Emily suffers a flashback of memory, which seems to indicate that perhaps she really did kill Conrad Harlow after all. Cue end of season one. So it wasn't bad. If I had to give it one of a rating like Perry gives for things, I'd probably give it maybe a 3.1, 3.2 out of 5. But I'm not currently planning to go on and watch the next season. So it was interesting enough, but yeah, I'm not going back there again, I think.
Oh, okay, so diverting, but would have been better if it just finished off
at
the first season, you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, well, the first one that I'm going to talk about is also is a television series or mini-series, crime mini-series. And this was only designed for 7 episodes, and that's it. And it works really well because of that. This the name of this one is Mayor of Easttown. Which if you've been driving around the streets of Melbourne, you may well have seen some large billboard ads for over the last couple of months. Well, no, you haven't done it, David.
Well, I have.
I've seen them. Maybe I've seen them because I've actually seen the program. You know, you see the advertising or something after you've already seen it.
Yeah.
I'd heard good things about this, so I decided to watch it. It's on the Foxtel platform. It's a crime drama, basically. So Kate Winslet, lead actress in this show, leads this excellent police procedural miniseries, which is set in a small town just outside Philadelphia. She plays the part of Marianne Sheehan, known as Mare, M-A-R-E. It's not Mare as in M-A-Y-O-R or Mare the horse, but her name is just Mare, M-A-R-E. And she's the lead detective in the local police force. Now, you find out that she actually grew up in this town, and it was well known as a major basketball player early on, and that leads into one of the connections with one of the storylines in the show. But you sort of think that it'd be very difficult to grow up in a town and then become the lead detective in the criminal agency there. You don't really think that the town is all that big, but it's got a two or three people in the detectives. Anyway, look, that's just minor things that every now and again you sort of sit there. And sometimes we just overthink things, David, and we just try and which I shouldn't do. Anyway, so look, Winslet plays this this woman who's a grandmother. She's divorced. She's a mother of a suicide. Her son committed suicide some year or so before, or a couple of years before. She's unkempt and she's slovenly. She drinks a lot and she swears a lot. She's basically a rounded human being that you could meet pretty much anywhere. She just happens to be a police officer. She's also good at her job, though she does at times allow her personal life to impact on her professional career to her detriment on one or two occasions. Anyway, the TV series starts off, and you find that for the past year she's been trying to solve the mystery of a missing young girl. The girl happens to be the daughter of a close friend of hers who was in her high school basketball team. So that's where that connection comes from. And so there's a lot of personal tension there. You know, you're my friend, you've let me down, you haven't been able to solve this. But there's been no body, there's nothing. The girl's just completely disappeared. And then we start following another young girl who's of a similar age to the daughter of Mayor, but this young girl is out and about a bit and goes out to a party out in the woods and disappears. And they think, oh, maybe this is another one of those disappearing acts that's happened. Maybe this is connected to the first disappearance. But then a body's found in a creek. And so they're not sure now whether this is a connection or not. Now, the mystery of this evolves over the course of the series. There's a lot of connections with Mayor and the other people in the town. You get excellent performances from the mother of Mayor, a close friend of hers. The kids are good. Look, everybody in this is really sets things off really, really well. It's an excellent drama that comes to a satisfactory conclusion. Winslet gives a wonderful, nuanced and gritty performance, discarding any need for makeup or overly fussy depictions. She basically shows the damage that the years have caused to her face. And I don't mean that badly. I just mean that she looks like a woman who's in her mid-40s, who's lived a life.
Mm.
And she's not dolled up so that every time she walks out, her hair's perfect and all the rest of it. It's all over the place. Shirt's half out and, you know, all this sort of stuff. Everybody does a really good job of the work that they do in this. And we actually have Guy Pearce, the Australian actor, appearing as a sort of almost like a guest role that floats through this particular drama as he's a author that's moved to the town for a while because he's got a teaching job in the local college. And he sort of basically hooks up with Mayor, and there's some, you sort of think, maybe he's got something to do with this because, you know, he's the stranger in town. You don't know whether he's involved in this or not. But I'm not going to tell you. You're going to have to figure out. There's a lot to like about this particular drama. I thought it was wonderful. Wife and I watched this and basically couldn't wait to watch the next episode. We watched one a night. Thought it was fantastic. There's a couple of issues that are left unresolved at the end, but that's life, really. I mean, but all the major ones are fixed up, and it's got a big twist at the end, which you don't want to tell anybody, because otherwise it'll just ruin the whole thing. Again, as with the most really good crime dramas, they lead you to think, oh, it's got to be that guy, and then you think, no, it can't be them. It's got to be this one. It's obviously this one.
Mm.
No, it's not them. So you're moving from one to another, and that's handled really well. They don't stay too long on it and make it too obvious, but something crops up, and you think, oh, I didn't know that. And that basically moves your suspicions away from them over to somebody else. Now, this is done very, very well in around the world. And it's been nominated for a number of, in a number of categories for the 73rd Primetime Emmy Awards, which are going to be coming up. So it has Winslet is astounding for lead actress, Evan Peters, who's the supporting actor who comes in to help out, comes in from another town to help out the investigation because the head of police in the town thinks Mayor's not really quite up to it and she's getting a bit too close, not doing things the way she should. Julianne Nicholson, who's Mayor's friend. Jean Smart, who plays Mayor's mother, for Outstanding Supporting Actress, both of those. It gets a nomination for direction and a nomination for Outstanding Writing. The trouble is it's going to be up against The Queen's Gambit, which we watched, and that's in a lot of these categories, so that means it's probably going to struggle, which is going to be a real pity, because if this was out there on its own without that other competition, it would win a heck of a lot of awards. It'll win some, but I don't think it'll win as many as it might have if The Queen's Gambit wasn't up there for those awards as well.
Sure.
I think that's probably got a better chance of doing really well. So,
what streaming service is that on?
Foxtel,
okay.
Foxtel at this stage. You'll probably have to wait for the DVD to come out, which will probably be later this year.
Well, if it's on Foxtel, it'll probably be on Binge, and I think there's something else I might need to reconnect to Binge for.
I would think so. And if you want to reconnect for Binge just to watch this, it'd be worth your while.
Sure.
It's quite an excellent piece of work. It really is quite good.
Indeed. Okay. Well, that's interesting for you to say all that because there sounds like a lot of similarities in many ways to what I'm going to talk about. So we'll go on to that. And that's Broadchurch. Now, it can take me a very long time to get around to watching some television.
This is a couple of years old, David. I saw this a couple of years ago before we started this podcast.
This was released 8 years ago in 2013. And probably everybody but me has seen it long ago. But that's not going to stop me talking about it because I've only just watched it. So it's available on Amazon Prime, and I see that there were 3 seasons of it made. But although we do have Amazon Prime, in fact, my wife and I watched it courtesy of a DVD of the first season, which she gave me for my birthday several years ago. It's taken me a while to get around to things. Anyway, suffice it to say that we thought this was very well done with some great acting. It stars David Tennant, Olivia Colman, and Jodie Whittaker as the lead characters. Interesting that two of those actors played the role of Doctor Who. Anyway, I see that it won several BAFTA awards and many, many other things. Like won something like 26 awards or something. It really, really did very well. Okay, so if you know the story already, just skip to the next chapter. But I'll give you my take on it. So it's set in the small community of Broadchurch, which is somewhere on the coast of Dorset in England. And Olivia Colman plays the part of Detective Sergeant Ellie Miller, who's just returned to work from an overseas holiday. And she, her husband, and son live in the town. And on getting back to work, she's outraged to be told that the promotion she'd been expecting isn't going to happen and that somebody called Alec Hardy has been given the job instead. Hardy, who's played by David Tennant, is a brusque, cold individual who really has serious trouble connecting with other people. He and Miller don't get on at all well. So Alec Hardy arrives in Broadchurch just in time to handle a major case. That morning, the body of a young boy is discovered on the beach underneath some high cliffs. Soon determined that the boy didn't fall from the cliffs, as was first assumed, but he's been strangled. Miller, on seeing the body, instantly identifies it as 11-year-old Danny Latimer, a friend of her own son, Tom. Danny's mother, Beth, only belatedly realizes that Danny's missing. He didn't go off, as she thought, on his usual early morning paper round. No one in the family saw him leave. He's not at school. She starts to search frantically for him. And when her car stopped in a traffic jam caused by the police activity on the beach, she abandons the car and starts to run towards the scene. Of course, she discovers that it was him. So the reaction of Beth and her family to Danny's death is harrowing and very convincingly played. But of course, the question arises, who murdered Danny and why? Is it someone they know? Broadchurch is a small community and the accusations and investigations and the failure to quickly solve the mystery start to break the town apart. Alec Hardy, we learn, is notorious for having failed to solve an earlier case involving the abduction of young girls. And Broadchurch is his last chance to redeem himself. So like in the series you were talking about, Perry, the series does a really good job of arousing your suspicions against many different candidates for the murder. And there are all sorts of interesting twists, and you think, oh, my goodness, is that why that person's behaving that way? Now, it's not really until right at the end, of course, that the shocking truth is actually revealed. And there was also some strong material in there, I thought, about the toxic role of the press in dealing with such incidents, which can blow up minor matters into sensational headlines. And at one point here, the national tabloids essentially hound an innocent man to his death. So I say we enjoyed this a lot. Olivia Colman's terrific as she tries to balance, as you say, with Mayor of Easttown, she has to balance her dual role of being a member of the community, and, you know, neighbour and wife and a mother, with that of being a senior police officer investigating a major crime. And Jodie Whittaker is also very good indeed as the bereaved mother, Beth, and her struggles to come to terms with Danny's death are, you know, very well done. David Tennant's almost always good, and he's excellent here in his character of this damaged police officer with serious emotional problems and a back history of his own. So it was good stuff. I'm glad I eventually got around to seeing it. I'm not entirely sure about following up later seasons, which apparently haven't rated anywhere near quite as good as the first one. As an aside, I see that a year after Broadchurch came out in the UK, the show was remade in a version called Grace Point, set in the United States, which also featured David Tennant in essentially the same role, which that was interesting. Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot.
I did as well when I saw it oh so many years ago. But it's actually interesting that it'd be worthwhile going back and having a bit of a look at that again. I think Whittaker, this is before Whittaker actually was cast in the role of Doctor Who.
Yep.
And I believe that because she had actually met Tennant after he'd left Doctor Who,
yep,
in this particular series, she was able to ring him up and said, look, I've been offered this role. What do you think? Mm. So he was able to basically give us some pointers. And yes, I think it's excellent. I mean, anything Tennant's in and anything Colman's in, just worthwhile searching out. I've seen a number of things that Tennant's been in over the last 12 months, and he's been tremendous. Same thing with Colman. I just don't have a problem with any of it. They just work really, really well.
Yeah.
And they work really well together,
yeah,
in this first series. And I think the writing in this first season is really good. It falls away in the second. I got through the second, wasn't overly keen, about halfway through the third, and thought, no, I can't take this anymore. It drops off really badly, which is rather unfortunate because it is such a good setup and such a good thing. But again, it's sort of like almost trying to move things too far beyond what they needed to be. That's why I hope they don't do anything more in Mayor of Easttown. It's done.
Mm.
It's perfect. It's done. Don't stuff about with it. Let it sit and just go off and do something else.
Yeah, I agree. That's what they should have done here, I think.
I think so. If they'd just done that one season, it probably would have remained at a higher level of estimation in people's minds. But because you do that second and third one, it sort of drags it down a little bit, which is disappointing. Okay, so I'm going to move on a little bit away from the concept of crime, which probably some people listening to this podcast probably think that's a good idea. So I'm looking, my next two, splitting them up, are going to be a couple of Disney Plus series, both set in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Now, I have to call it the Marvel Cinematic Universe because it is actually different from the Marvel Comics universe in subtle ways. Well, the Marvel Comics universe has been running now for, like, I don't know, 70-odd years. And so it's been going around all over the shop, reinvented itself for quite a large number of times. Nobody seems to get old, of course.
Of course not.
But the Marvel's... No. So the Marvel Cinematic Universe has been going for about 10 years, started off with Iron Man with Robert Downey Jr. all those years ago, and culminated, and I get lost with how many phases there are. I think it was phase three, I think they called it, with the two big Avengers movies that I discussed on the podcast. I think the finalizing with Avengers Endgame in 2019.
Yep.
The first of the series I'm going to talk about, Loki, is based on the character Loki, played by Tom Hiddleston. He's played this particular role since about 2013. I think he came in the first of the Thor movies. And he's excellent in this particular role. Now, for those that don't know, Loki is the in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is the god of mischief. He's the adopted son of Odin and the brother of Thor. Now, the action of this particular series takes place after the events of Avengers Endgame and fills in a gap in Loki's story, because basically in that film you see a scene where Loki steals the Tesseract. Now, this is going to get really complicated, because if you haven't been following what's been going on in the Marvel movies, some of this makes not a lot of sense. The Tesseract houses the Space Stone, which is one of the Infinity Stones that Thanos is basically looking for in order to be able to implement his grand plan of destroying half the life in the universe. Now, in that particular movie, Loki steals the Tesseract and then is brought, in this series, he wakes up and he's brought before, or he's brought to this mysterious Time Variance Authority, which is a bureaucratic organization that exists outside time and space and monitors the multiverse's various timelines. Its role is to try to keep the timelines down to one major preferred timeline, so it sort of cuts things off. And it has decided that this particular Loki is what's known as a variant, that is, formed in another timeline and is not following the universal one. And so the TVA basically gives Loki a choice. You can either be erased from existence, or you can help us track down the other Loki variants that we need to get to make sure that they aren't messing around with the timeline. Now, obviously, Loki not really wanting to basically fall into the trap of being erased, and because we actually see him after in the Marvel in the movies, we see him after the time when he disappears with the Tesseract. We know that he takes on the role of a consultant, and he's working here with a man called Mobius, played excellently by Owen Wilson, who's wonderful in the role, just, you know, sort of laconic, laid back, and he and Loki have quite a good interaction. That they work along things very, very well together. So Loki ends up basically becoming a consultant. They go through how many episodes that I figured? The 6 episodes of this particular season, all of about 50 minutes or an hour each. Loki basically starts trying to help the TVA to work out how to make sure that the timelines are all basically following along the grand plan that it needs to follow. He actually ends up, Loki, this one, ends up at the end of time, literally the end of time, meeting other variants of himself. One is a woman called Sylvie, who's played wonderfully. One's the classic Jack Kirby-drawn Loki, played by Richard E. Grant, believe it or not. He was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. Just choose the scenery, fantastic. Has a great time. He's only in it for a couple of episodes, but he's really, really good. Another one that he meets is a young Loki who reveals that the reason why he's there is he's killed Thor. And this Loki goes, okay. Don't know how that happened. And one's actually an alligator.
Okay.
Don't know what's going on there, but that's interesting. All right. The plot here is really complicated. Jumps around all right. It's so complicated and so obtuse. It's too difficult to go into beyond what I've given you there. And that's mainly the problem with this particular series. It looks wonderful. It's well made. It's well written. But I wonder if it's more of a love letter to comics fans than acting as a bridge between Marvel Comic Universe installments. Hopefully it'll improve, but I really got the impression that the storyline here wasn't really aimed at explaining anything in particular, but it was, and it just ends up trying to look too clever and just sort of misses the mark a bit, unfortunately. I mean, I'll watch the next season when it comes out, because there has been a second season announced, because it doesn't really end on a point where you can say, right, okay, that is an end point. It sort of seems to open it up to something even bigger. I'll watch it, but I'll watch it warily, and, you know, I'll probably try and I won't be watching it one a week. I'll probably wait until it's almost all finished and then watch it all in one big hit and see how I go. I know there's a lot of discussion about this particular series over on the internet where people were thinking it was absolutely wonderful and it was explaining whole heaps of stuff. Didn't explain much to me. I was a bit confused by just about all of it. It looks good. There's some interesting things in it. I don't know. I think it misses the mark a bit.
Well, I'm going to talk about a series called Hannah, which is definitely an Amazon original. And I really enjoyed this. And I watched my way through both season one and season two within a couple of weeks, which counts as binge watching for me. I doubt that there'll be a third season of this, but it's possible, I guess. So it's based on the storyline of the 2011 feature-length movie Hannah, which I admit I haven't seen. That movie featured Saoirse Ronan as Hannah, Eric Bana as her father, and Cate Blanchett as Marissa Weigler. So, really excellent cast. Now, David Farr was apparently a co-writer on that film, and he was given the chance here by Amazon to fill out Hannah's story into a fully-fledged television series, which has now turned into two seasons and a total of 17 episodes. One of the nice things about Amazon Prime, certainly Amazon Originals, is that there are some excellent behind-the-scenes little clips that you can watch with a lot of the series. And this one is pretty well covered for that. So one of these behind-the-scenes clips here features David Farr, the writer. And he talks about how he wanted to explore more of Hannah's beginnings and to go more into depth about the other characters. And he also says how paranoid he felt when he was casting the parts for the television series. But in the end, he felt that he got it quite right, just right. And I'll talk about the cast momentarily, but all the actors chosen really, I think, were very, very good in this. Anyway, I'm kind of talking about this series the wrong way around, back to front. So let's start with the basic story, which combines an exciting suspense story, an action thriller, with a really well-done and often touching coming-of-age story. So we start with the character Eric Heller, who we discover was a special services soldier for some Eastern European nation. He's a trained assassin. He's played by Joel Kinnaman, who is the one who plays Edward Baldwin in Apple's For All Mankind. This is a very different role. And he's actually perfect in this role. So as the story opens, Heller enters a secret facility in Romania after hours. It appears that he must be working there because he has some sort of access card to get in, and he knows the guards there. He goes into a room filled with cots where babies are sleeping, and he selects one particular child, lifts it up, hides it out of sight on a trolley, and smuggles it out of the building. Next thing we see Heller with a woman in a car racing along a road being chased by a group shooting at them, trying to stop them. And the woman's hit by a bullet and she dies, and so Heller takes the baby and runs into the woods with this child. Several years pass, and then we see a young girl, perhaps she's 14 years old. She's trapping animals in a snow-covered landscape. Suddenly, she's grabbed from behind by a man. They struggle fiercely, but she overcomes him and puts him into a stranglehold. And this is Hannah, who Eric Heller has been raising since she was a baby. And the man is her pseudo-father, Eric Heller, who's trying to train her. That's why he grabs her, and she's got to recover from that. So he's been training her intensively to be able to defend herself, and he warns her that people will come after her and that they'll want to kill her. So she's told never to leave the forest. Now Hannah's played by young Esme Creed Miles, who does a brilliant job of combines the innocence and sense of fun of someone who's barely out of childhood with these martial arts skills and the fitness and the hyper-awareness of a special services soldier as her father was. And this is a strange combination. It gets her into strife several times during the story. So Hannah eventually does stray beyond the boundaries of the forest, despite her father's cautions, and she begins to come in contact with the outside world. But unfortunately, that leads to the authorities becoming aware of her existence. And as Eric Heller has warned her, they come after her. And this begins a chase sequence across Europe as they try to catch her. The third major character in this is that of Marissa Weigler, who's played here by Mirelle Enos. And she was the person in charge of the Utrecht research center from which Heller abducted the baby. It's all part of a secret CIA program to genetically alter children and raise them to create an army of assassins. Now, when Hela stole Hannah away, Weigler was forced to euthanize the remaining children and to shut the facility down, lest its secrets be exposed. This terrible act has caused her serious mental harm, but she remains dedicated to Utrex, and when Hannah's existence is discovered, Weigler is determined to track her down. So Hannah is briefly captured as part of the story, and she's taken to a secret location, but she cleverly and violently manages to escape. She escapes into the Moroccan desert where this facility is. And here she joins up with a British girl, Sophie, who's on holiday with her dysfunctional family there. And she gets a lift in their combi van all the way back to, well, I think she leaves them in somewhere in Paris, somewhere like that. Anyway, while she's traveling with them, a close friendship grows up between the two girls. Hannah's quickly learning about the outside world and society. But Sophie, of course, doesn't know anything of Hannah's past or her skills. And so she's completely shocked when Hannah is attacked by Utrex agents, and she cold-bloodedly and methodically uses her skills to violently escape from these people. Not sure whether she actually kills one or two of them, but she certainly does them serious harm. There's a lot more to the story. We learn Eric Heller's backstory, how he came to work for Utrex and why he stole Hannah from the secret research facility. There's also an interesting character arc to Marissa Weigler, who'd been attempting to create a normal life outside her work and to settle down with a lover and his son. That relationship is destroyed in her obsessive quest to recover Hannah. But her allegiance to Utrex also begins to break down, and eventually she changes her attitude towards Hannah. When Weigler learns that this research program has restarted only a couple of years after Hannah was born, without her knowledge, she begins to work against Utrex. And that restarted program, and it's the group of girls who have been raised and trained as part of it, are the focus of the second season. Look, I just think this is great television. It's really well worth watching. The casting is indeed very good. There's plenty of tension and many well-done action scenes. I've talked about the behind-the-scenes little pieces that come along with this, and in one of those, Esme Creed-Miles talks about the intensive physical training that she had to do for the part, including learning martial arts skills and becoming extremely fit, so that most of the action scenes are actually done close-up with the actors themselves rather than stunt people. But there are also some very moving parts to it. I'm particularly thinking of the friendship that Hannah develops with Sophie, and later, particularly in the second season, with a girl called Chloe, who Hannah helps to escape from Utrex. And I was also particularly struck by a really poignant scene in the first season where Hannah, she's on the run in Berlin, but she walks into this gorgeously decorated cathedral where a choir is rehearsing a beautiful religious piece by Thomas Tallis. She stands there transfixed, the first time she's seen such beauty and heard such music. A new world seems to have opened up before her. Before I finish, I've been going for a long time, I know, before I finish, and speaking of music, I mustn't forget to mention the haunting theme song of the series, which was commissioned for the series and written and performed by Karen O. It's called Anti-Lullaby. I can't sing it, I won't sing it, but I'll just read the first verse of it. Do not sleep, my starling, sleep, my doe. She is wrapped in curtains laid in snow. She will bury you inside her fur. Do not sleep. She waits for you to sleep. I just think that last line's chilling. It's really, and it keeps recurring through the series. Very good. So, highly recommend. I love this series. I would gladly watch the whole thing again.
Okay, it's one I think my wife would probably like then, so I'll have to try and track that one down and watch
it's
it with
on Amazon Prime, yeah.
Yep. Okay, well, that's good. Well, I'm again doing another Marvel Cinematic Universe miniseries, and this is a miniseries because it goes for 6 episodes, called The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. Again, this follows directly on from the film Avengers Endgame 2019, and this really is acting as a bridge between that particular film and what's going to be coming up next in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. If you've been following anything along with this, you'll know that the Falcon, well, Captain America and the Falcon was a major comic series for a long period of time. The Winter Soldier is actually Bucky Barnes, who's an old original friend of Steve Rogers before he became Captain America. Bucky Barnes basically ends up being captured by the forces of evil and basically turned into the Winter Soldier and acts as a an assassin. But he's been rehabilitated, brought back to the fold, and no longer works for Hydra. He now works for the good guys and joins up with his old mate, Steve Rogers. Well, in Avengers Endgame, what happens there is that Steve Rogers Steve Rogers and the rest of the Avengers have to go back in time to be able to change some timelines to make it easier for them to be able to defeat Thanos. But Captain America doesn't return from the past. He stays there and he lives his life as he would have lived it, because as you recall, he was living way back in the 1930s and 1940s, but at one point was ditched a plane into the Arctic, into the ice, in order to stop a particular major cataclysmic event occurring, and was lost. But was went into a form of suspended animation and woke up again 70 years later, not knowing where the hell he was. So his whole life had disappeared, including the love of his life. He never got to spend time with her. So he took the opportunity in Avengers Endgame to actually change his timeline and go back and stay there. When everything's fixed up at the end of Avengers Endgame, all the Avengers are sitting around and they look over to a park bench and there's an old man sitting there, and it's Steve Rogers, because he knew where they were going to be at that particular time. He's turned up. He's now quite old, 80 or so years old, and he hands his shield to Sam Wilson. That is that's the character's name who's playing the Falcon, and says, "Here, this is yours." Well, the Falcon uses the shield for the first episode, but then realizes that he doesn't really think that it's for him, because he rejects it and hands it back to the government, because he can't work out how a black man can represent a country that doesn't represent him. And so straight away you're starting to see this is slightly different from the standard Marvel Cinematic Universe stuff that you normally deal with, because you're now starting to get sort of a little bit more of a political and social commentary utilising the African-American actors here to comment on the political standpoint of the country that they are supposedly representing and defending. So it's really quite interesting. Anyway, after that's a quite interesting thread that runs all the way right through this particular series, and is a lot more obvious here. I think some people didn't really like it very much. Well, tough. This is the real world, and things like this are going to turn up, and it's handled quite well, and it's quite an interesting question. And Sam Wilson, the Falcon, basically has to fight with his own. His own self as to whether he takes on a role that he's been given by one of his great, great mentors and friends, or does he put it aside and just go back to doing what he was before? Anyway, what happens is that because he's handed the shield back, the US government appoints the US Army Captain John Walker to be the new Captain America, because, you know, they have to have a Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
Now, John Walker's new Captain America and his partner, they always seem to have a partner, attempt to bring down a terrorist group known as the Flag Smashers, who basically really liked that period between those last two Marvel films when half the people in the world were dead. They thought that things were referred to as the blip period. They liked the blip and want to go back to that. Bit hard to do without killing half the people, but anyway. So John Walker is trying to break down the Flag Smashers, but things go badly wrong, very badly wrong, in public. And it's quite obvious that Walker isn't up to the moral standard of Steve Rogers in the originals, and he's eventually forced to give up the shield and doesn't have a dishonourable discharge, but the next thing to it, basically. Now, who else have you been keeping up with the Marvel films? But this one's easier to follow than Loki, I think. Mm-hmm. I think you can enjoy that without all that background if you just come in and watch it. The chemistry between the two main characters, Anthony Mackie plays the Falcon and Sebastian Stan plays the Winter Soldier, is really good. It adds a lot to the social commentary about what's going on. And I think this will make this whole section fit in very well with what's going to be coming up. And I found this to be a very satisfying series. Not fantastically spectacular, but it's satisfying because it sort of is, it takes a couple of characters off to one side, away from the big blockbuster things. It's still very, very well made, let me tell you. They spent a lot of money on these things in terms of the special effects and all of the direction and the sets and everything. It's just, it's wonderful to look at, because there's a huge amount of money made by these Marvel movies and billions of dollars, and so they have a lot available to them. But this is there to fill in that bit that they need to move from one part to the next. I thought it was worthwhile. I suppose, look, if you're not a comics fan, if you're not a fan of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you're probably not going to like this terribly much, but you could watch it even if you haven't watched all the movies. So that's probably a bit of a bonus.
Indeed. All right.
Well, I think that basically takes us to the end of the television. We haven't talked about it for a while, and I have to crack the whip on you, David, to start watching a bit more TV. You don't have to watch ours, and you have to binge watch, although sometimes that's been quite a good thing to do in lockdown. But, you know, an hour a night here and there, you sort of, it all gradually builds up. It's a bit like the idea of reading. You know, you read a sort of set number of pages a day, and then before you know it, oh, there's another novel gone and another book gone and another collection of short stories gone. So, that all builds up. It all builds up.
Sure.
Anyway, so I think we're done for this week after all of that. I think there's some good television there that people might want to have a look at. You've picked up a couple and I've picked up some, and hopefully I've warned people that some of them's, you know, almost specialist interest. But anyway, that's hopefully that's given people something to think about and watch.
Sure.
Next episode, we're going to go back to the 2021 Hugo ballots and look at the nominated novelettes. There are six of them. Now, the novelettes, as people will recall, are those stories that sit between the 7,500 and 17,500 word limits. So if you like the, what are named, long short stories, but they are short stories, and we'll be looking at all of those. Hopefully we'll both be able to get through to the stage where we read the whole six of them.
Sure.
And then we'll probably give our choices as to what we think is going to win.
Sure.
We may have something else coming up. I won't say what that is just at this stage. I'm trying to arrange that and get that together, but we shall see what happens next episode. So until then, David, it's been good talking to you. Stay well.
As always. Yep.
Stay warm.
That's right.
And we'll see you in a fortnight.
Indeed. Okay, thanks. See you.
See ya.